Right, so we're back, Dave. It's been a while since we've done one, and just to explain to our army of fans, then we have had technical problems, we've had illness, or I've had both of those things. So, so we're back, but we've got a good pod, hopefully, for tonight. We are talking about the Indiana Jones films.
Yes! Dun, 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 ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba.
Fantastic. We've got four to cover.
We have.
But
well, that's a good sound, Lee. That's a good sound.
Yeah. So where should we begin, Dave? Should we begin at the beginning? With Raiders.
The best film ever.
We will get on to rating them towards the end. But give us your memories of Raiders, Dave. I presume you went to see it at the pictures when it came out in 81.
I went to see it at the local pictures. As a kid, with me mum and my kid brother Paul, and I went there thinking, I hope this is going to live up to the expectancy of the trailer, of what I'd heard about it, the book. I may have even read the film novelization first, you know.
Really?
I kind of think I did.
Did that come out before the film then?
It might have done. I'm not, that's a bit hazy, to be honest, Lee. But what I can tell you for certain is that when I came out of that cinema, having watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, I thought this was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life, because it delivered on every level. The anticipation, the expectancy of going in to see this action-packed adventure film. And I was absolutely apoplectic with excitement at every stage, because it delivered on every single fucking level.
Well, you say there that, you know, this was the best thing you'd seen at that point. Can you think or remember what films you'd actually seen before? I mean, had you seen Jaws, Close Encounters?
Oh, I'd seen lots of stuff. I'm not sure I'd seen Jaws, to be honest with you.
No.
And actually, probably, I mean, I love Jaws. Jaws is one of my favourite films. Maybe in time, over time, it probably pushes Raiders down a notch. But I think the first time I saw Jaws, because I wasn't allowed to see Jaws as a kid. I was just a little too young in 1975. And my older brothers had seen it. And I was dead jealous. But I was kind of obsessed with it. So I made all these, I did all these drawings of the different sequences and all the famous scenes in it. And when I first saw it, I thought, oh, it's a bit slower than I thought it would be, which I thoroughly appreciate now. I mean, I love the fact that it builds up so beautifully, Jaws, and it has so many great scenes, and it's a great piece of work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you could even say it's possibly a great piece of cinema. It's got great acting. It's got real people in it who really live in Martha's Vineyard, real characters. It has such authenticity in many ways that takes away from the fact that the shark perhaps is a little bit rubbery. But I don't even think that, to be honest. I think the shark's great. I just think it's a great,
great... For people like us, we didn't really have many real reference points when it came to sharks.
No, we didn't. So, we didn't.
To me, it looked pretty good at the time. And, you know, it's still decent for me. I've never been bothered by it. I went to see Jaws at the cinema. Now, I would have been 5 years old when it came out, so I'm pretty sure I didn't go and see it then. But
first time
I think it was probably re-released in about 78 when Jaws 2 came out.
Yeah, possibly.
I think that's when I went to see it. And I remember, I mean, I don't remember, but my aunt who took us said at the end of the film, I stood up and said, oh, well, he didn't eat many people, did he? Sounds like I was quite underwhelmed. And not scared. It's funny you should say that about Raiders, though, that you had seen the hype and the trailer. Would you have seen the trailer in the cinema then?
I think there was a trailer on TV too, you know. I'm sure. It was quite well advertised. And I remember the paperback, the novelization of it, having this lovely sheen on it. You could get it in blue, red and green, almost like you know, metallic paint around the fabulous picture of the poster.
Yeah.
So that was very enticing too. And I kind of thought to myself, I want a couple of copies of it in different colours, you know? And thinking it seems so exciting. I loved the premise of what the story was, or what I thought possibly the story was. This kind of treasure hunter, this action adventure treasure hunter. So when I went to see it, and this is the point I'm trying to make with Jaws, kind of like yourself really, where maybe the first time I saw Jaws, I was a little, and the same with Star Wars, I wouldn't quite say underwhelmed, but it didn't kind of live up to my imagination, you know?
Yeah.
I think over time, certainly like the second, third viewing of Jaws, that was it then. I was completely hooked and thought, yeah, it's amazing. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I love the pace of it. I love the feel of it, the acting and the suspense. But the thing with Raiders, it was really immediate.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm making. It was so immediate.
Exactly. So it gets into that. It's a sort of theme or a part of each of the films, isn't it? They have like this exciting prologue at the beginning that, you know, really grabs your attention. Which is very different to other films.
Absolutely.
And other films Spielberg has made. But
yeah,
my experience of Raiders is sort of quite the opposite of yours, because I went to see it. I would have been 10, I think, when it came out. 10, perhaps 11.
Mm.
And it was a friend's birthday party. And as was quite common back in the day, that's what you did. You know.
Yes, you went
you
to
know,
the pictures.
You'd go to the cinema, you might go ice skating. But I knew nothing about the film. I remember I kept asking somebody what it was called, because I couldn't seem to get it in my head, you know, remember what it was called. I was thinking, is it something to do with Noah's Ark? You know, because that was my only knowledge of what an ark was then. So I had no idea what it was about. And I don't even think I saw a poster.
Wow.
But as I say, it grabbed me from the very beginning, as it would have done everybody.
Yeah.
And it just continued from there. There was like no let up. Although there are some scenes where it calms down, it was just the most exciting film I can remember seeing ever. And
exactly. I think that's such a great point about being the tender ages that we were. You were like 10. I would have been 12, 13. The thing with that was, is that you're at that tender age where you want a film to have all the kind of elements that you love, like almost like the James Bond-esque excitement of car chases and boat chases and fight scenes. And you want all that, but you want it to be wrapped around a really gripping story. And it had everything right up to this kind of supernatural element at the end, which really delivered with a bang. Everything about it just worked.
Yeah.
And it had that element of the page turner. The clever thing with it, when you look back on it now, is that each action scene is a little bit like, will Indy survive this? Will Indy make it through that? Just like the old serializations did. But you're actually watching that in the space of a film. So there's always these moments of jeopardy that somehow Indy, oh, he's just made it through and survived.
That's what Lawrence Kasdan, the writer, said he found difficult. It was presented with all these set pieces that Spielberg and Lucas wanted in, but it was up to him to work them out.
Piece them together.
So they'd like tell him, oh yeah, Indy gets trapped here, or, you know, this thing's after him, or the Nazis have got him cornered. And it was up to him to figure out how to get Indy out of it. And also another problem he had was getting him from one location to the other, because obviously it does move about the globe a bit, doesn't it, the film?
It certainly does. Yeah. And I think Lawrence Kasdan deserves massive plaudits to what he did with that
screen. Massive.
Massive. In fact, I know that Raiders was nominated for the Best Picture in 1981 or two, and it was up against some other big films that year. So you had films like Reds, Warren Beatty film about the start of the Soviet Union. An American writer goes over there to witness all the changes in Russia. And it's a great film. And Chariots of Fire, of course, the British film about the Olympic runners, a brilliant film. But Raiders is still the most memorable and possibly the best film. You know, from the point of view of like a brilliantly crafted, put together film, directed, written, you know, cinematography, you've got to say Raiders is, it should not be diminished
No.
By the fact that it's an action adventure film. It should not be diminished by that in any way, shape, or form. And actually, it's probably the most commercial action adventure film in some ways, along with Star Wars, I would say, and to some degree, perhaps Jaws, but certainly Star Wars, to have ever been nominated for the Academy Award for Best Film, because it is a magnificent roller coaster ride, but it's brilliantly written, it's brilliantly staged, and each scene works perfectly into the next. And that is to do with Mr. Kasdan, how he's written them, how he's, it's seamless, how he's joined those pieces together, those moments of jeopardy, and then back on to the next stage and pushing the plot forward. Wow.
Yeah, there's absolutely no crap bit in it, is there?
There isn't. There really isn't. And I think that was it. It just delivered. So I'm getting kind of slightly emotional thinking about it. It just delivered so much. So as a kid, you go, oh my God, it's perfect. I just kind of had this sort of moment of serendipity, or this moment of this eureka, perhaps more appropriately, sort of eureka moment when I left the cinema thinking, this is the perfect film. For me, at that time in my life, this was perfect. Everything just worked so brilliantly, and it was...
It lingered, didn't it? The feeling and the excitement lingered for a few days.
Absolutely.
After seeing it. I can't remember when I saw it for a second time, because, you know, at that time...
I know, it was weird, wasn't it?
5-10 years to come on TV, and I don't remember ever seeing it on video again.
And it was never the... And I'm sure your family was the same. It was never the culture in our house to be going back to the pictures to see the same film over and over again. Even something like Raiders... It was like we saw it once and then that was it. And then it was all in the mind's eye. And in a way, that's a wonderful thing, because you're remembering what happened and then you're picking up every little bit of memory of it, which might have been the novelization. So that may have been after. Or magazines. And there was lots of little magazines and things at the time. Or even, you know, Stan Lee or whoever would have done like Raiders comics, you know what I mean? Like you used to get the Star Wars comic, didn't you?
Yeah.
It was like through Marvel or whoever.
Yeah.
And so you were sort of reliving it again in your own imagination back at home. Mm-hmm. Or just going in the garden. I mean, I don't mind admitting, as a 12-year-old kid, I was out in the garden pretending to be Indiana Jones and making up a new adventure probably, you know? But I'm channeling my 12-year-old self tonight, and I'm going back to that moment, and I was apoplectic with excitement, man.
I always find with, you know, any of my favourite films that, and films in general, that the genesis is really fascinating, you know, to see how this film evolved. And with Raiders, you may or may not know that it was George Lucas had this idea of bringing back the serial or making a modern day version of those Saturday morning serials. You know, they used to be 10, 15 minutes long and then they'd end on a cliffhanger like Flash Gordon, Zorro and things like that. So he wanted to make that, and he had to shelve the idea because I can't remember what it was now. Did he want Philip Kaufman to direct it? And I think he shelved the idea because he was busy working on Star Wars.
That's right. And of course, famously now we know that initially they wanted Tom Selleck to play the lead role, didn't they?
That's another aspect. There's loads of, you know, you can find out who was considered for these roles. But
I think Robert Redford may have been up.
Chevy Chase, Dave. Can you imagine?
They wanted Chevy Chase. Well, of course, Chevy Chase then was like quite this hulking, dashing looking guy, but he was also known to be a good comedian. So there is good comic elements.
Well, did he ever do a serious film? Because I thought Chevy Chase came through Saturday Night Live.
He did. I can't think that he's done any film that isn't comic. I might be wrong.
Maybe he wasn't a serious... I think Jeff Bridges was seriously considered.
And, oh, was he? I didn't know that. Jeff Bridges, great actor.
Yeah, he would have been good. But apparently Ford was considered, but he'd done Star Wars. And the idea was they wanted an unknown. Spielberg, I think it was, that said, you know, Ford is perfect. Though, of course, Tom Selleck was offered the role.
Yes.
And he did a lot of the pre-production and stuff, but he had to...
He was contractual to
he was contractually obliged, wasn't he, to do Magnum. And the makers of Magnum heard about this film and you know, they made sure, probably paid him a few more quid to do Magnum. But so how different things would have turned out then. Indeed. I mean, you still would have had the great writing and the... But for me, you know, no one could have been better than Harrison Ford.
he's brilliant in it. And to use that, not I'm going to overuse that word serendipity again, but the fact that Lucas came up with this fantastic idea, and massive credit to Lucas.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great ideas man, and, you know, maybe his best idea. You know, I mean, obviously Star Wars fans would argue Star Wars, but what a fantastic idea. The Indiana Jones stories are, you know, a particular, the sort of birth through Raiders, and great character that Indiana Jones himself is. Then to get Spielberg on board, to get Ford on board, and then to have Kasdan write it, joining well, all Kasdan, the links.
I think Kasdan at the time, Dave, had only been a screenwriter for a very short period of time.
I think that's true.
But yeah, I mean, Lucas originally called the hero Indiana Smith.
Yes.
But Spielberg apparently hated that name because I think it reminded him of a Steve McQueen. Is it Nevada Smith? Something like
Nevada
that.
Nevada Smith, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they all agreed on the name Jones. And yeah. It was Philip Kaufman involved quite early on. And Lucas really wanted Philip Kaufman to direct it.
Yeah.
But he wasn't available. And then I think it was only chance, really, that Lucas had mentioned it to Spielberg, you know, because Spielberg came on quite late on. And
quite
Spielberg
late.
Always wanted to direct a James Bond film, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he thought that, well, this is pretty similar.
Yes,
indeed. So he let him do it. The way he made films around that time was incredible.
Yeah, you know, without doubt.
The use of the camera, the editing, everything else.
Yeah, he was brilliant. Like we've just already been speaking a lot about Jaws, but Close Encounters of the Third Kind too, which is a brilliant film. And a real, you know, some of it's quite a tough watch. You know, some of it's quite almost like an art film. And it's not by no means a fast-paced film. But I sat my son and his best mate down to watch that some 2 years ago when they were about 11 years old, 10 or 11 years old. It's way over 2.5 hours long. And they were gripped by it from beginning to end. Now, of course, the subject matter is very interesting and very unusual. Not that unusual these days with everything that's been happening. But they were totally gripped by the story. And if you think of it, it's not an action. It's no Marvel movie. It takes a long time to get going. He paces the scenes and he builds up the suspense so brilliantly in all those scenes.
Yeah, he does.
If anything, Raiders of the Lost Ark and possibly the other three films is the fastest paced film that Spielberg's ever made.
Yeah.
Possibly the later ones, even more than Raiders, to be honest. You know, when it comes to like pretty much non-stop action scenes, which that's unfair to say that as well, actually, because there are lots of pauses for breath in Raiders. It's just that on first watch, it doesn't really seem that way. First watch, it just seems like amazing scene, Jeopardy, escapes Jeopardy, amazing scene, Jeopardy, escapes Jeopardy. But actually, if you watch it, there are these little lulls to bring you back up again. It's all about timing, isn't it? Mm. The timing's perfect.
That's what I mean. The pace is difficult to get right in a film.
When does he get it wrong, though, Lee? This is the thing. You watch his films and they are beautifully put together. He's like one of these great classic filmmakers. He's a throwback as well to like the William Wylers of this world, like the John Fords. He paces the film so nicely. The scenes are so well put together. And they are very compelling and real, even if some of the stories and the ideas are not. Some of them are in a kind of world of fantasy or exaggeration. Yeah.
Well, have you ever heard of a film called The Secret of the Incas?
That rings a bell, but I don't know if I've seen it.
Well, if you look it up on the internet and see any pictures from it, you will see Charlton Heston.
Right.
Dressed as Indiana Jones.
You're joking. That sounds amazing.
Well, obviously he isn't.
He isn't.
But that absolutely is where they took the look of Indy from. He's got the fedora, he's got the leather jacket, he's got the tan pants, he's got a bag.
That's brilliant. Brilliant bit of research, Lee.
And the film itself is about Charlton, a very young Charlton, trying to find some artifact in Peru.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Mm, that is brilliant because they've taken the look for Indiana, if nothing else, haven't they? You know.
Yeah.
And of course, that opening scene is almost like paying homage to that because it's like he goes, it is like the South American and the Incas.
That's true, yeah.
He gets the head of the idol. You mentioned it briefly before, It's such a wonderful, wonderful opening scene. Talk about drawing you into a story. It mirrors that James Bond ethos, which is...
Yeah, that's right, because Bond always has a bit of of a scene like that at the beginning, doesn't it?
Which is detached from the main story, but it's this it's this action opening that gives you an idea of what this guy's about and what's going to happen, or it's going to be emulated in a different way later on when you get into the main story. So you have this lovely little treat at the beginning before the opening credits, don't you?
And very cleverly introduces Belloc. We see what Belloc's all about.
So we know what's going to lie ahead. We see the lead and the lead nemesis, the white hat and the black hat, as they say. Yeah. Although, ironically, Belloc's wearing white, I seem to remember, and Indy's got the dark colours. But anyway, we see the protagonists right at the beginning. But that opening sequence is fantastic. You know,
that sets the tone of the film, because Spielberg balances like a kid's film with an adult film really well, doesn't he? He's always been brilliant at that, you know, making films that appeal to all generations. And you've got the bit where we find out he's scared of snakes.
Sure. What we're also doing in that scene is we're getting to understand the personality and the character quite a lot, because in a similar way that we understand that Bond is not just brawn, he's brain, we find out even more with Jones, because what he does is he's figuring out the puzzle, if you like. He understands what he has to do to safely retrieve the idol and put the weight down. Obviously, it doesn't quite work, because having got to that stage, the weight isn't quite right and all the trapdoors open up and all the pitfalls begin. And it's so brilliantly done, because when he runs out of that room and all the poison darts fly out of the walls and the stepping stones that he has to pass over, which he does successfully initially, he just has to go for it to save his life. And it's so exciting.
And the betrayal of what's his face?
Alfred Molina. Who goes on to be a big star in his own right. Yeah. who plays the Mexican...
It's unrecognisable there, isn't
he? He does, unrecognisable. And he plays the Mexican guide, kind of a Sherpa type character, taking him into the temple, who betrays him.
Yeah, and then he's comeuppance, doesn't he?
And it's a magnificent mini film in itself, isn't it? That opening scene.
Yeah.
Super. Brilliant. And quick mention, the cast is so good, because you've got the likes of Melina, haven't we? And, you know, Karen Allen as the female lead. She's
Karen
fantastic.
Allen is brilliant.
Brilliant.
She's so much charisma.
Yeah.
She's feisty. She's funny. She's amazing. And Ford said she was an absolute joy to work with. He absolutely loved working with her.
He obviously loves her, doesn't he? And you know, she just seems like a laugh. And she's got that sort of tomboyness about her, hasn't she, as well as being like really attractive.
Well, you know, it was first choice for that part, Dave. Deborah Winger.
Really?
She turned her nose up at it.
Well, she shouldn't have turned her nose up. I could imagine she'd have been quite good, actually, because I quite liked Deborah Winger, especially back then, in the early 80s. I'm glad Alan did it, because she couldn't be bettered. And it's got these fantastic British character actors in it, hasn't it, Lee?
Yeah, Ronald Lacey.
Yeah.
Who, his character, Top, was offered to Klaus Kinski, I think.
Oh, well, Klaus Kinski is a great actor, you know, a really weird...
But you know who nearly played Salah, Dave? John Rhys Davies' character. Danny DeVito.
Did he really? Oh, I think that would have been good. I have to say, I love John Rhys Davies in it.
Yeah.
The old crazy Brexiter that he is. The old mad, sort of alt-right lunatic, but in real life, but... He's a great actor. He's great in that. Fantastic. Mm. And they're all, like you say, Ronald Lacey, Denham Elliott. They're all great in
it. Oh, yeah, Denham, yeah.
And, of course, Pat Roach, the wrestler, the great wrestler.
Who's in it twice.
Indeed he is. Indeed.
Yeah. Gets killed twice.
Gets killed twice.
Imagine him getting the script for, like, Temple of Doom and thinking, oh, fucking hell, I get killed again.
I think he must have been in on the joke, though. They must have had a good laugh about that. He was like the Kenny of the Raiders films, wasn't he, or the Indiana Jones films. Who killed Kenny? Who killed Pat? Great. Yeah.
Most people will know him from the first film and the second film, but he was actually in the third film. Do you know where he was?
Where was he?
Right, well, one of the big scene that was cut out was on the Zeppelin. right?
Ah.
Where he's accompanying, is it Vogel, the German officer that Jones chucks off?
Right.
Right. So you remember when Henry and Indy get on the Zeppelin and then see the shot from their window, and Vogel is walking towards the Zeppelin to get on it, and he's accompanied by a burly Nazi, and that's Pat Roach.
So wow. Sure,
watch it again, you'll see it. But the scene that was supposed to happen after that is Indy has a fight with Pat Roach
on the Zeppelin,
but it was cut out for whatever reason. I like that. I like that little link, you know, that Pat Roach is in the three films.
I think I love it because they obviously loved him. It's obviously a family, and there's obviously a great deal of love for everybody when they're making the films.
But my son loves Raiders, and he's only 7, and we watched it a few times together. And the one scene he absolutely loves, and you've mentioned it, is the melting face scene when they unleash the power of the Ark. And even though it's cut out of bloody, you know, we were watching it on TV the other day. We just turn over and Raiders is on, so we started watching it. No. We get to that bit.
They cut it out.
They fucking cut it out.
That opening of the Ark sequence is so brilliant, and the ghost figures for the time, those effects are brilliant, and that brilliant change of music by John Williams, which again, you know, you should never underestimate the impact of John Williams' music in any of, especially Spielberg's films.
They are the absolute hallmark, aren't they?
I mean, absolute hallmark.
And so many memorable pieces that he's done for Spielberg films.
So many themes within the film too, you know, with all his films, really. So many other little themes that work so beautifully. And that's the case with that arc, opening of the arc scene, where it suddenly goes into this kind of haunting pacing, like this, and you just know, oh my God, it's all hell's breaking loose here. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Indy, Harrison Ford and Karen Allen are keeping their eyes tightly shut, they're realising through Indiana Jones's learned understanding of what the Ark's power is, to not look at it, to not look at the power, because the power will kill you and will destroy you. But everything else and everyone else who has looked into the heart of the Ark of the Covenant is going to pay with their lives and rot in hell as a consequence. Yeah. It is brilliant.
One interesting fact I'm reading here is that Lucas suggested that Marion would have a romantic past with the much older Jones at the age of 11.
What?
He didn't do that. Can you imagine
fucking
how that was played
hell.
Out now?
What, with like short, with the older Jones, as in short?
Well, you know, not necessarily getting physical, but, you know, maybe
you mean like she had like some kind of... When Indiana Jones was like a young man of, say, 15, is this what we're talking about?
Possibly, yeah.
She would have been about 11, and he would have had it off with her.
But Spielberg replied, no, she had better be older.
Fucking hell. I mean, Lucas, it makes me
wonder. I suppose if it's like you said there, you know, a bit of a crush, it would have been no problem, but, you know, people could have misconstrued it, as they probably would.
Fucking weird pedo. I mean,
another thing about the Marion character, another one that was up for it or nearly played her, was Amy Irving, Spielberg's wife. So he didn't get her to do it that time, but he got Kate Capshaw to do it, didn't he, in his in the sequel.
Yeah, well, I think
so. He always seems to be trying to crowbar his missus into the film.
Well, he was probably the thing with Capshaw, though, he's sniffing around Capshaw because he got rid of her. I think that's what was going on. I think even Irving had split up by then. I might be wrong, but
it's still together though, aren't they, Capshaw?
Yeah, him and Capshaw, they're incredibly successful.
Eight kids or something.
They've got loads of kids, a massively successful Hollywood couple, aren't they? They've been together for decades, mate. Mm-hmm. Years and years and years. And that leads us on.
It does.
That's an interesting little segue onto
the sequel stroke prequel. Is it a prequel? Is it a sequel? It's set before. So.
It's a very good point, my friend. Mm. Oh, a quick point to make. There's a fantastic documentary where the huge fans of Raiders of the Lost Ark, just like Lee and I were, but they took it a step further and decided to recreate the whole film.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And I think it's called Raiders, the greatest home movie ever made or something like that. I think that's what it's called. And it's a fascinating journey.
Yeah, they do a shot by shot remake, don't they? Which is incredible, you know, because they only have
years to do.
I don't know if it's a Super 8 or one of the early camcorders that they use, but a magnificent achievement. So they've only just finished it, haven't they? Because didn't they? There was some scene, I think it was the plane scene where Pat Roach gets
mauled by a propeller,
gets mashed up. That, you know, they didn't have a plane to hand, so he had to wait a few years to do that scene.
apparently
they finally did it. Yeah,
it's amazing, isn't it? That's
great thing to do. That great idea.
That's real dedication and love for a particular film.
Who was it that brought that to everybody's attention? Was it Eli Roth or somebody like that?
It may well have been. I think
it was shown at a festival, you know, a low-key festival, I think.
You guys listening to this, go and check it out. Find these things out and you can tell us, send us messages. If we get anything wrong, you can tell us, can't you? But it's definitely the case that real filmmakers were really impressed with this incredible undertaking, you know, and this love and devotion for a particular film. And I bet it's had a huge impact on a lot of modern day filmmakers, to be honest with you. It'd be really interesting to find out, you know, there's got to be people of my age and your age who have been gone to the pictures and seen it as a young teenager or a preteen and just been bowled over by by Raiders' brilliance. You know, sadly, most kids today know it as Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
It was called Raiders of the Lost Ark. That is Lucas all over, fucking about with his stuff.
Yeah.
Why retitle? It was the original Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, you didn't need to be putting Indiana Jones in front of it.
No. But when Temple of Doom came out, by that time, Indy was well known. He was a household name, so that was in the title.
Yeah, that was fair enough. That was the original title, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, you know. So 84, Dave, can you remember going to see it?
Yeah, again, pictures. And I think pictures because Raiders was just so massive. And this time, I think we all went, you know, there's seven of us. And I think maybe all seven of us went. Or I certainly remember going with my mum and my dad and other siblings, but fantastic. I thought it was brilliant. I remember the whole cinema clapping and on their feet almost when the scene when Indy nearly loses his hat and just managed to grab it back before the big concrete door comes smacking down. That was at the end of this great sequence, and that brought the cinema down.
It still gets me on edge, that scene, Dave. You know, it's such a horrible way to die, isn't it?
Oh, horrible.
And
horrible.
You've got Willy fucking about being
an annoying little prick.
Yeah, just being annoying. And there's that great bit where he goes, "We are about to die."
Sorry, I'm mixing Willy up with Short Round. It wasn't Short Round who was in it. It was Willy, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Short Round was in with him. He was in.
Yeah. Wasn't she called? What was she called? She's called
Willie.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I was mixing that up. She's called Willie. And she was being so fucking annoying, you know. And she was really annoying at times in that film. She was great in it, but really annoying too.
Yeah, I like her character. I think it works well.
But it was, that sequence was in equal measures, you know, filled with jeopardy and incredibly frustrating as well, because she was being so obnoxious and annoying. But it ends with that great moment, and it brought the cinema down in a very different way, but similar way in some respects as the scene we didn't talk about in Raiders, which was the fantastic Market Square scene where Indiana has had enough of fighting. Sees the great big Arab guy wielding his sword in all different directions, like nunchucks or whatever, and he's wielding his sword around, and then Indiana just thinks, oh god, I can't be arsed with this, and just shoots him dead in the street, and everybody killed themselves laughing and cheered and clapped in the pictures.
Yeah, well, that was Ford's suggestion, that, because Spielberg was trying to direct him and choreograph this crazy sword fight.
He was sick as a dog, wasn't he? He was really ill or something, I think.
Yeah, he did. He had dysentery, I think.
Yeah, that's it.
And dysentery. He just said, well, why don't I just shoot him? And he went, oh, yeah, let's try that. And like you say, it works brilliantly. Don't they try to recreate that in one of the later films? I can't remember if it is Temple of Doom or Crusade, where he gets his gun out, goes to shoot someone, and he's run out of bullets or something, so he does end up having to fight them.
He does. I just want to say, I've got a criticism, though, with Spielberg over Temple of Doom, and that is that he's a pussy. That Spielberg is a pussy. I mean, he now talks about it being too scary, and yeah. I regret making it scary. That's what made the fucking film.
Yeah,
made it good that it's dark and scary, you know, and that there's human sacrifice in it, and the baddie rips people's hearts out. That was great. That's what you wanted.
I don't know much about who wrote the film, actually, Dave. Do you?
No.
Probably easy to find that out, but
it would be easy.
Yeah, but apparently there was a lot of elements that were in the original Raiders script, like the minecart scene.
Yeah.
That was in Kasdan's script, that, and so was, you know, the gong, hiding behind the gong.
Yeah, I've heard this. These are spillovers that they decided to put into the next film.
Yeah, because Spielberg, you know, got them cut out. He said the film's too long, really. So
I bet it would have been wonderful to have been a fly on the wall with Lucas and Spielberg, and possibly Kasdan as well, if he was involved in the sort of bouncing ideas around.
Yeah.
Where they were just coming up with all these different scenarios and fantastic action sequences for Indiana Jones to find himself involved in and in jeopardy in, and to have this great sort of bouncing back and forth of ideas about what trouble they can put him in. Then obviously after having these like 20 or 30 crazy brilliant ideas, have to sort of go through the process of measure of editing it all down to where they want it to go, you know. Yeah. It would have been great to have
it would. Apparently they spent about a week or two together, and they were working like 8-9 hours, you know, on the treatment of the film, and
they are
trying
they
to pull are. It all together. That's yeah. Raiders I'm talking about.
Yeah, but, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. Like I said, I love finding out the genesis of these films, because they don't just come out of nowhere, do they? It's not like someone just sits down and, you know, writes this. You know, they take a lot of planning, a hell of a lot of thought, and so many ideas would be discarded.
Well, because they're very nicely put together. I mean, you know, particularly Raiders, but, you know, you can't really say that Temple of Doom isn't either. You know, it's very well structured, really well put together, full of fantastic set pieces. You know, I will have to say, it's got some great character actors in it. Again, no one better than the Indian actor who plays the incredible.
Yeah, he plays Mala Ram. I can't
remember. Mala Ram. He's a terrific actor, and he's got
face. He's perfect, isn't it? I think was he just
great presence,
like a Bollywood actor at the time.
Yeah, I think he was a Bollywood actor, or certainly an Indian film actor who certainly wasn't known in, you know, film circles, in Hollywood conventional film circles. Mm-hmm. But great presence. I mean, wow. He was a good baddie. Very convincing, very menacing, dark. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe did too good a job for Spielberg in the end, because I think Spielberg found it all too much. But I was disappointed with Spielberg's reaction to that.
He did say at the time something like he felt that when he made Crusade that it was almost an apology, because he did get a backlash actually at the time, you know, for it being too dark and too scary.
Right.
I don't remember it that way. And like, you know, my son watches it now. He's not frightened by it. He's excited by it. He knows it's not real.
Of course. And to be honest with you, the scariest scene in any of the films is the Ark of the Covenant scene in Raiders. Nothing scarier than that. What there is in the Temple of Doom sequences is some nastiness, is some kind of really sort of premeditated violence, which is nasty. Hence, you know, throwing people down a well of fire, you know, in lava, and ripping people's hearts out. But you're not really seeing anything. It's still kind of fantastic in a way. And
I don't think the audience minded that Willie was nearly sent into that fire.
No, I think by that stage we were thinking, just throw her in there for fuck's sake.
Yeah. It's how Spielberg does this. I mean, on the surface, it can appear that it's very violent, very dark. There's always a laugh around the corner, you know, so you don't get the impression that you're watching a serious horror film or anything like that.
No, not at all. There's the element of the comic strip about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
The element of the conventional superhero, not like your Marvel superhero, you know, wearing his underpants on the outside of his leotard or whatever, you know. Never really quite got that, to be honest with you, that side of things. But it's
DC, Dave, really.
Well, is it? Is that DC more? Yeah. I don't mean to diss it. I know lots of people love it, and I've got a couple of friends who really are into it, but I can never really quite get into it, to be honest. But Raiders, most definitely. And I think it's because it has that air of, just that air of realism in the fact that they could be a real person, but it's got the fantastic about it, in the same way that Tarzan has the fantastic about it, the same way that King Solomon's Mines has, you know. And obviously, there is a bit of a pull from all those kind of things in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom. It's got that kind of influence. And of course, the Saturday morning thing, the Mark of Zorro, and I know very, very different, but Flash Gordon, the idea that these are real people, if you like, thrown into fantastical situations, you know, and it works a trick. I have to just say very quickly, is the amazingly ridiculous scene of the fight on the mine trucks through the mine.
You always say this is ridiculous, Dave, but I bloody love that.
Well, I love it. Don't get me wrong, I do love it, even though you can tell it's in parts.
Imagine how hard that would have been to do, though.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. There are little bits in it where it's, the effects not quite, but it's charming. You know, it's really charming. Yeah. And a lot of fun. But there's one little scene in it, of course. There's one little moment where Harrison Ford throws a punch and it misses, and he starts laughing. And it's almost like it shouldn't be in the film. And I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that little sequence, because it's like, oh my God, they've kept that in. It's a little knowing nod to the audience.
Yeah. Well, another element that's really good about Temple of Doom is Short Round. I think he's a great little character.
He is, yeah.
And the kids love him, and you know, he's really well played. And that was a clever idea to team up, Indy with a kid.
And I tell you what's great about that, Lee, as well, is that you said like the kids love him, and I think the point with this is that it's wonderful when there's something that's affected you so much as a kid in popular culture, and then you can pass it on to your own kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, you know, showing my lad Raiders and Temple of Doom and seeing how he was really into them when I showed them to him, you with your lad at a similar age, really gratifying. Yeah.
His favourite is Temple of Doom, actually. Though he has been saying that Crystal Skull has been his favourite recently, which... each to their own, Dave. You know, maybe he'll change his opinion. But interestingly, one interesting aspect was apparently Harrison Ford nicked a lot of the one-liners that were originally given to Short Round.
Really? You're not having these.
I can't think of.
I'm using these lines.
I can't think of which one-liners he would have been able to nick.
Hey, Mr. Ford, you let me down. I want these lines. Go fuck yourself, kid. These are my lines now.
Yeah. Well, the story's really good, isn't it? About, you know, the kids being enslaved and, you know, Indy getting these chakra stones and, you know, releasing the kids. And it's a wonderful moment where they all come over the hill back into the village. Good ending, you know, satisfying film, and great scene on the bridge.
Great scene on the bridge. Yeah. Great scene. And the village scene, which is almost has this little element when he goes to help the village out initially with this sacred stone, has that little element of like the Magnificent Seven in a way that he's going to free the village and help the village. He's going to come in to help this desperate village. I love that element about it. You know, it has to be said, another great scene in it, although perhaps the woke political correct sensibilities of today may suggest that it is kind of racial stereotyping, but the banquet scene is is a lot of fun too, even though it is a bit, there are elements of a kind of ain't half hot mum kind of racial stereotyping going on there a little bit.
Well, I didn't come away for that film thinking all Indians at bloody eyeball soup and monkey brains. You know, it's just a bit of lightheartedness, isn't it?
Well, the whole film, you know, all the films, I mean, come on, you've got like John Rhys Davies playing an Arab in it as well. I mean, the guy is quite keen to get rid of most of the Arabs out of Britain these days, you know. This is the irony of it. This baritone Welshman like this, you know, get them all out of here. Hang on a minute, you're playing a bloody...
He does look Middle Eastern, though. I mean, it's interesting that He's that, Welsh.
That magnificently Welsh voice as well as Salah, you know, because it's and then probably Spielberg goes, hey, yeah, the, you know, you Welsh, you sound a bit like, you know, Pakistani, so maybe you should.
But I'm just reading what Spielberg said about it, and it is quite depressing, really. I wasn't happy with Temple of Doom at all. It was too dark, too subterranean, and much too horrific. I thought it out-poltered Poltergeist. There's not an ounce of my own personal feeling in Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom is my least favourite of the trilogy. I look back and say, well, the greatest thing I got out of that was when I met Kate Capshaw.
They are sniffing around. I certainly, whatever flaws Temple of Doom has, and it does have a few flaws, you know, that opening sequence is brilliant. That sort of Busby Berkeley Hollywood kind of musical sequence. And then all the kind of the finding the remedy from the poison he's drank and the shoot 'em up scene. And oh, it's fantastic. It doesn't stop, you know. Right up to when they're on the plane, and lovely little cameo from Dan Aykroyd there. And they have to come off the plane using the life raft, this inflatable raft down the hillside. Oh my God, it's just wow.
Well, I've got a problem with the plane scene, Dave. I made the mistake of posting this on an Indiana Jones fan site. I mean, I was doing it slightly tongue in cheek because, of course, you have to suspend your disbelief when you watch these films.
Yeah.
But when he gets on the plane, he thinks he's escaped Lao Che, doesn't he?
Indeed.
It's a great bit where he closes the door and you see it's Lao Che's plane, and Lao Che signals to the pilot. The pilot signals back that he, you know, he understands. And my feeling was, well, why doesn't the pilot just not take off so Lao Che can capture Indy and kill him?
He just said, I'm working for Lao. Puts a gun on him, says, I'm working for Lao Che. He's coming. Yeah. Film over, or just shoots Jones.
Was it an insurance job? Maybe yeah. That plane was on its way out. Did he want to kill two birds with one stone?
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
All he needs to do there was not have that signal between Lao Che and the pilot. You know, and it would have worked.
Exactly.
You know, because we know it's Lao Che's plane. So
why would Lao Che want to just destroy his whole plane, like you say?
Well, that's just what I'm thinking. Insurance job. Or it could be that he wants Indy to die hundreds of miles away and it looked like an accident. But he didn't seem that arsed about killing him in public.
Oh, I see. There might be something in that.
My argument to that would be that he was openly trying to kill him
in
the nightclub, yeah?
Yeah, with hundreds of witnesses. So why would he give a shit if his pilot decided to just turn round and shoot Indiana Jones through the throat, end the film there? Just the shortest Indiana Jones film, and he's dead, right? Yeah, the job is done for you, Lao Che. Like that. Jones is dead. I've killed the bitch too, and the kid, we're going to take the kid and sell him on to paedophiles in Britain or something. I don't know.
Oh, God.
We'll sell him to the mines. We'll take him to the mine where they use the kids.
Yeah. Well, he didn't know about the mines. They weren't connected to the mines, were they?
You don't know. Hey, we don't know that. You know, this is another world. This is another plot. Maybe Lao Che knew everything about the mines, but we just never get to know that.
But again, when you see it on TV, it's cut to shreds, isn't it? You know, you don't see the beating heart.
No.
They'll be cutting the banquet scene.
It's too scary for the kids. It's too scary. It's bullshit. Let the kids watch it. Have a bit of a laugh.
We grew up scarred.
Of course we did. We grew up, Scott. Do you know what? The amount of stories I got about, say, Jaws that I wasn't allowed to go and see, it just made me want to, you know, oh, there's a bit where there's just a hand on the beach and it's been eaten by crabs. So I just used to draw it as a sort of 7 or 8 year old thinking, oh, my God, that's amazing. But because it had these really kind of graphic scenes, Jaws should never have been an A, let's be honest.
No. It's a much more serious film than Indy, isn't it?
It's a 15, surely, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, Ben Gardner's head bobbing out of the boat, the leg that falls to the bottom, blood pouring out of it.
It's just fucking scary when the shark.
It's scary as fuck.
On the rampage.
Quint's absolutely bloody cut in half by the shark, blood pouring out of him all over the place at the end. I mean, Christ almighty, the film is full of some really nasty scenes. But because there's no swear in it and no sex in it, it gets an A. Yeah. It's really interesting that, isn't it? The censor, certainly the American censor, puts more precedent on a bit of tit and a bit of effing and jeffing than someone getting shot dead or mutilated by a shark, then it gets a lower certificate.
Well, I suppose you could argue that anyone taking their kid to it, what did you think it was about? It was about a shark. It's about a shark that he's killing people.
Yeah. You know, look, bring your kid to this, all right, but be aware, you know.
Though I love that story about the Woman in Black remake when, you know, all these Harry Potter fans went to see it, because originally it was, I think it was a 15, but because Daniel Radcliffe's in it, the filmmakers are trying to get a 12A certificate for it so they can drag in the Harry Potter fans. But a lot of them went to see it and were absolutely scared shitless and left traumatized, because it does deliver some really scary moments, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a completely, probably different type of scare that those kids were used to, because Harry Potter's got its scariest bits in it, but it's not the same, is it, at all?
No. But what is interesting is those, if you like, there are a degree of subtle differences. So, for example, if you said John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, which is deservedly an 18, I should imagine, has the scene where the ice cream vendor just totally cold-bloodedly shoots the little girl and kills her. And it's really like, it's a shocking moment. But is it not a truly shocking moment when the Kitna boy, I think he's called, in Jaws, he's out on his yellow Lilo. Yeah. And then he gets murdered by the shark with all blood spurting up. That's a fucking horrible scene. It really upsets me when I see that. This is a 13, 10-year-old, whatever child having a nice time on the beach, and he gets mute. He gets destroyed by a shark. And Jaws is still an A. See my point?
But if you think about what we were subjected to as kids in the 70s, you know, the traumatic public information film, you know, armchair thriller being on at 2:30 in the afternoon, things like that. We are the haunted generation.
You're right.
You know, there was no watershed or anything like that. It was just, we're putting this on.
I'm not even sure, you know, mate. Was Raiders an A? It may have been.
It must have been an A.
But Raiders is touch and go an A. You know, that end sequence, Temple of Doom, again, you know. Yeah. But after saying that, they are more in the realm of the fantastical, if you like, of fantasy than, say, Jaws is. That's the point I'm making. Yeah,
definitely.
You know.
Talking about the darker tone, I think you've told me before that may have been attributed to the difficulties Spielberg was having at the time, wasn't he? In the middle of the divorce of, Amy Irving.
I think in one of the documentaries about the films that he says something along those lines, that he was in a pretty dark place prior to making, or around the time of making, Temple of Doom. Yeah. So that might have been a trigger for what he perceives as being dark. But I just think it's a lot of fun myself.
Probably say, out of them, I'd probably put the next one we're going to discuss as the most lighthearted and the most humorous, which is obviously Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. What are your thoughts on that film?
When I first saw it, I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was really up there with Raiders. And over time, I don't quite see it that way, you know? I feel like it hasn't quite lasted the test of time in the way that Raiders has. But I still really enjoy it. Yeah, I just kind of think that it's hard to judge everything against Raiders, because Raiders was such a great film, I think. You really were climbing K2, weren't you, after you've made Raiders.
What bothers you about Last Crusade, then? Where do you think the
Nothing bothers me about it. No, nothing bothers me about it. I think there's some great stuff in it. I just kind of feel that, from a personal level, I don't feel as enthused to watch it as I probably did maybe 10 years or so ago, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas if Raiders is on, I go, oh yeah, Raiders. And it's probably all built on nostalgia, that sense of feeling. It's probably all about nostalgia, but there's certainly great things in it. I mean, bringing in Sean Connery as his dad, I thought was a great move. And I think that works really well. There's good sort of camaraderie, teamwork between the pair of them. And Denham Elliott adds some quality sort of comedy asides, especially towards the end. And it's a great cast of characters. There's nothing bad to say about it. And the end delivers really well. The super sort of supernatural finale does work, even though it's true. You know, it's completely fantastical. You know, it's completely fantastic. But the idea of actually finding
the Grail,
the Holy Grail itself, and well, there it is, been guarded by this knight over thousands of years, you know. Or
well, I bet he was already taking on that job, didn't he?
Yeah.
Sat there waiting for someone. And then as soon as somebody enters, he tries to fight them, doesn't he? He tries to hit Indy with his sword, but he's too heavy. He's an old git.
I kind of thought there's such a lot of great scenes in the run-up to the end that at first I even when I saw it as a younger person, then I'm not sure about this, but it won me over. You know, that final sequence won me over.
Yeah.
And you know, the idea of picking the right grail out of this list of other cups was a very, very clever idea to save a life. You know, a very good little twist at the end, and a lovely sort of off into the sunset finale as well. You know.
Yeah, that's great. A great bit, that. Well, I've loved it when I saw it. I saw it twice, actually, because I loved it so much the first time. I just remember it being so fast-paced. It just seemed to be fighting from start to finish.
Can I point that out, Lee, that I have to say that I'm with you on that. And I think what I meant initially was is that I don't have the enthusiasm for it now, but when it first came out, I was really pleased. I thought it was a very satisfying film along the lines of Raiders, because in some ways, Temple of Doom, it kind of hit and missed a little bit. You know, there were some great scenes in it, but it didn't quite have it didn't quite nail it for me.
Didn't
Whereas
it?
But I felt like the Holy Grail, you know, did.
Yeah, it was a great, great sort of plot device, that. But it gets criticised a little bit for being a bit too like Raiders, you know, this religious artifact that they're after, and it's the Nazis again. But as I say, I loved it when it first came out. I think it topped Raiders for me for a few years. You know, it was a sort of film I preferred to watch than Raiders. I'd say things have changed since then. But I loved the interplay with Connery and the idea that that's what the search is for, isn't it? It's not the Grail, it's their relationship. Originally, in one of the drafts, Indy wasn't going to meet his dad until at the end. Was it Jeffrey Boehm? It might have been, or some other writer had suggested, you know, why don't we have them meet halfway through the film and then we can have this double act? Credit has to go to Connery because apparently his character was written like a mad professor, you know, this very eccentric guy that Indy's able to boss about.
Yeah. But
Connery was not having that. He says, no, I don't think it should be that. I think it should be more subtle, and you know, he should be a proper father and someone that Indy's in awe of or respectful of. Spielberg wanted him straight away. You know, it was the first name he thought of when the idea of having his dad in it. And I think it was Spielberg's idea, that, because Spielberg's very heavy on that sort of thing, isn't he? Like the father and son, E.T. and Jaws. There's a bit of that with Roy Scheider and his son.
There's a lot of the psychiatrist chair in a lot of Spielberg stuff because
definitely,
things to do with the relationship he had with his father, which is quite interesting, really, I think. And maybe we should do a podcast all about Spielberg, full stop, you know, because he's an interesting character. And there are mixed feelings with his dad, I think. But yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think Connery's great. What's great about Connery, because Connery's got this sort of gravitas, you know, he comes in, he's like, you know, in anything he does, he's like the big man, isn't he? You know, like when he did I don't know, all the Bond films, of course, but, you know, The Untouchables. Everybody knows him for that scene in The Untouchables, you know. They come at you with the knife. You get them with the gun. That's the Chicago way. And there's no attempt in any of the films for him to change his Scottish accent into, when he was doing, like, Highlander, he was supposed to be an Egyptian, but no, I'm an Egyptian. And he's still Scottish, you know. And
then you never see that in the credits, do you? Voice coach for Mr. Connery.
No, never. And Hunt for Red October, he's a Russian commander. It's like, I am a Russian. I believe in the Soviet Union, you know. Like, and then Untouchables is supposed to be Irish. Interesting Irish accent he's got going there.
He doesn't give a fuck, does he?
Let me tell you something. I don't give a flying fuck. You Americans don't know an accent from a fucking squirrel, right? But the thing is that when he comes in that film, he's great because, and I think it's a really good bit of acting by him, because he does play a boffin, but he's still got this big physical presence. Comes in, he's like, Junior, Junior. And he's always got his head in a book, or he's off with the birds a little bit, like a boffin. And yet, when required, he shows a little bit of the Indiana. There's something in there, you know, especially with the physical presence. So it all kind of works really well, doesn't it?
He doesn't get handy in the film, though, does
no,
he?
No, but he's got a kind of physical presence, is what I mean.
He does it in a subtle way, you know.
In
like
a subtle way, correct.
When he uses his pen.
Exactly.
He uses umbrella to scare the birds into the
fighter pilot.
You know, that's quite a good idea, that, to have him dealing with these threats in a completely different way to Indiana Jones, you know.
He's using his brain more than brawn, you know. But it's great, and it's kind of counterintuitive to what you would expect of Connery, because even then, you know, as he's getting on a bit, he was still the tough guy, you know. He was the Rock, you know, in The Rock as the ex-SAS man. He was
hairpiece.
You know, the Presidio, where he fights that guy with just his thumb. Oh, take you out with my thumb, you know. And right up till then, Outlander, all these films, Highlander, he was still playing a strong, heroic figure, because I am Sean Connery, you know. And that is kind of turned on its head a little bit in The Last Crusade, which is good, I think.
Well, the reason he didn't want to do it at first was because he's only 12 years older than Harrison Ford. He was like, don't insult me. I'm not old enough to be his dad.
Oh, brilliant. But Phil's not ego.
And then Spielberg persuaded him. You know, how did he persuade him? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, what I've heard...
Maybe he just loved the script and he thought, this is sounds like good fun, because apparently that's why Harrison Ford does it. You know, when he came back for Crystal Skull, he says, we just have a great time doing these films. That's why we all want to do them.
Sure, and I'm sure it looked to me like they got on really well and had a lot of fun. I think Connery and Ford had a lot of fun together. They enjoyed each other's company. From what I've heard about Connery, he lived up to the stereotype of the Scotsman, you know. Pay me the right money. Don't rip me off. Make sure I receive everything I'm entitled to, and I'm your man. But fuck with me, and I'll be off the fucking set in a jiffy. I heard Kevin Costner talk about it. He was unbelievable, he said, as far as knowing the finances of the film and what he should be getting, and, you know, and what he should have. What and he was sort of... Is. Say again, sorry.
What his actual worth is.
What his worth is to the...
And that's the thing. He didn't put in a performance, did he? He really... His performance is amazing, and his character's brilliant. It's hilarious. You know, I think that's the highlight of the film for me, the hilarity between the two of them.
Oh, it's brilliant.
The developing relationship.
In fact, I thought he was probably unfortunate not to get some kind of nod from the Oscars, really.
Surprised he didn't, but it was definitely worthy of a nomination.
Definitely, absolutely. I thought it was a great performance, and, you know, sending himself up, or the stereotype of how he was perceived. He was still, let's be honest, he was, around that time, he was still a leading man. He was getting leading roles in big films, you know. So to take...
Usually with a hair piece on.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like the Medicine Man. Entrapment.
Was he wearing a hair piece?
An amazing ferret, a grey ferret on my head in Entrapment. There you go. But Sean Connery, what a great actor, what a great character actor. Mm-hmm. In fact, if anything, actually, he probably wasn't given enough plaudits for some of his performances. When you look at other people, like, in his sort of field, and he probably had the right to feel a bit bereaved about the Bond image kind of screwing things up a bit for him. Yeah. Because away from Bond, he put in some great performances, like The Hill, you know, and... he wasn't probably acknowledged enough for some of the other stuff he did. That was really, really good. And his presence was fantastic. And other people around him, like Michael Caine, Richard Burton, Albert Finney, all his sort of peers of that time, Richard Harris, they did get a lot more acclaim. You know, when I mean acclaim, I'm talking critical acclaim, really, and awards, which mm-hmm. at the end of the day don't really amount to that much, do they? But it's probably a bit frustrating for someone who's a big star only to be recognised for one role, you know, whereas the likes of, you know, Kane was very good at escaping that because he made several very good films, you know, especially in the 60s and carried on accordingly.
Carry on accordingly.
That's a new one. Yeah. Yeah. He only had a very small part in that one.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best bits for me in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and you would only sort of appreciate this if you were British, was when Hitler turns up and it's Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill. Michael Sheard. Now, coincidentally, Dave, I'm watching all the Grange Hills. I may have mentioned this, but I'm watching all the Grange Hills with my son. And we're just on the Bronson years.
Oh, brilliant.
He's really picking on Aunt Jones and they've just had a bit of a fight. Do you remember Aunt Jones?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Another one with his wig. I mean, it's a shame he was never seen in much else. He was in Alfie Does Impert as Herr Grunwald. But he's a very, very good actor.
This ties in beautifully with what we're talking about, because when we were talking about Raiders, talking about the Oscars, weren't we? Talking about what films were up for the Oscars that year. One of the films was Reds. And funnily enough...
In that?
No, well, listen to this. It wasn't Bronson, but it was Roger Sloman was in Reds. Roger Sloman. Ah. From Nuts in May, another great
and
British
Grange
character.
And Grange Hill, Dave. He was the first PE teacher in Grange Hill.
Oh,
the first
get
episode.
Out of town! He wasn't.
He was.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was only brief.
I don't remember Baxter as the game
teacher.
Yeah,
Baxter took over soon after, but he was in the very first episode and he catches Tucker flicking summer at Trisha Yates. So
have a guess, though, who Roger Sloman. So this is great. Two characters from Grange Hill, two stalwarts of British TV shows, right? One plays Hitler, and guess who Roger Sloman plays in Reds?
Stalin.
Close, go on.
Lenin. Oh, I've got to see that.
Oh, fantastic.
Spielberg's always put British actors in his films, hasn't he? And a lot of the filming is done in Britain, I presume.
Yes, I think that's a big part
of it. So that's probably a big part of it, yeah. But maybe he'd seen a bit of Grange Hill and thought, looks a bit like Hitler.
That'd be ace.
Hair. Because Bronson did have a bit of a Hitler hair.
Yes. Not,
didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He was Grange Hill's Hitler as well. He was such a shit.
That's what's great about Grange Hill, though. There's some real proper bastard teachers in it. I mean, Lucas, when I've been reading up on the films, I've always known he was obviously involved and he was a producer, but he's massively involved in them, hasn't he? He's wrote or come up with a lot of the stories, a lot of the ideas.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason why the films have taken so long, I mean, it's amazing when you look at how many drafts and how many different ideas were written and then abandoned. It's because Spielberg and Lucas have not been in agreement on a lot of things, a lot of plot devices, a lot of scripts. Mm. So they've got more writers in. And it appears that there has to be four people that are satisfied. Well, actually three. So you've got obviously Spielberg, Lucas, and you've got Harrison Ford, who seems to carry equal weight.
Wow. And didn't know that.
Because obviously you can't do it without him. So he understands his power there. But it's not an ego thing. He wants to just make the best film possible. So he's rejected loads of ideas in the past. I think he wasn't very keen on doing the alien idea.
Right.
In Crystal Skull. But the fourth film, which we're going to go on to talk about, was in development, like, I think, even possibly before Crusade came out. Because Lucas and Spielberg have always been churning around these ideas.
Yeah.
And... It got delayed for quite a few reasons, one of which was Independence Day came out in the mid-90s. So they thought, oh, fuck, they've just stole our thunder with the alien invasion stuff.
Yeah.
Nazis were involved in a early draft.
Right.
Spielberg had made Schindler's List, so he couldn't bring himself to satirise the Nazis anymore. So it took till 2008 until everybody came to an agreement and everybody was satisfied with the script. But yeah, so eventually 2008 we get the fourth film, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Indeed. Indeed.
I think we're probably in agreement here that we don't think it's up with the other three in terms of quality.
Well, I seem to remember us all going to the pictures to see it, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. It was huge enthusiasm.
With huge enthusiasm. There was at least five of us that we all went with great enthusiasm as lovers of the trilogy, you know. And you're quite right about The Last Crusade. I mean, and I agree with you on The Last Crusade, is that it was such a joyous piece of entertainment. And it finished on this terrific high. And it seemed almost like, okay, if it ends there, that's fine.
This is yeah, and I don't films. Think any of us had any idea that
no.
there was any chance of another one coming out. But apparently, Lucas and Spielberg had signed to do five films in the late 70s before they made Raiders.
It seemed like a really great trilogy, didn't it, at that point? It
yeah.
did, because there was Temple of Doom, maybe a little bit of a lull, but there's so many great scenes in Temple of Doom that you still go, you know what? Great entertainment, you know. And the other two films, superb, you know. And then comes Crystal Skull.
Can I just say, Dave, but one thing I remember about us going to see it was you went up to the box office.
Yeah.
And just said, one for Raiders, please. Remember?
I don't, but I can.
And the guy didn't bat an eyelid.
Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Quite right, too. One for Raiders, please. Oh, man, that is ace. I didn't know that. I don't remember that at all. But
as I remember it, Dave, we all came out pretty chuffed. But in hindsight, I think we were trying to lie to ourselves a little bit.
Yes, I think we were.
There was just something not right about the film.
Certainly over-egged the ending. It was hugely over-egged, you know, and maybe Ford was right about the Crystal Skull alien element, because, you know, that's coming from me, you know.
I liked that. I thought it had been set in the 50s, the B movies. I thought that was a really clever idea.
Okay, that's interesting. The other thing that I personally think of that maybe kind of let it down, do you know what? Some of the actors in it. There was too many actors in it. You know what I mean? Like well-known actors. So you've got Ray Winstone, you've got John Hurt, you've got Kate Blanchett. They're all playing it big time, aren't they? Winstone's pretty terrible in it, I have to say, I think, in retrospect.
Yeah.
And Kate Blanchett too, as the sort of over-the-top Nazi.
Yeah, she's a bit cartoon-like, isn't she?
And if it's somebody else playing that who you don't know, you can buy into it.
Yeah.
But it's Kate Blanchett, it's Ray Winstone.
Well, the Ray Winstone character is just so fucking annoying throughout
it's
the
really
whole
annoying.
Thing. Because, you
totally
know, he
annoying.
Keeps changing sides. I mean, how many times does he double-cross Indy? And at the end, Indy's trying to save him. And it's like, let the bastard go.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
He's chucked you under the bus six times already.
Yeah, absolutely. There's things in it that I did like a lot. You know, there was some great scenes in it. I really liked the return of Karen Allen. She's great.
It is great to see her. She's the best sidekick.
Yeah. She's a great actress. She's a totally underused actress, I think, over the years. I think she should have been in many other great films. She was great in Starman, but I can't think of many other things that she was in, really. Mm. Well, it's been the curse for Spielberg. Most of his female leads don't do a lot. I mean, Dee Wallace, she didn't do much after E.T., did she?
No, that's true. Yeah.
She did Cujo, that was about it.
Was that after E.T.?
I can't remember, mate. I can't remember. She didn't do much.
What's the face from Jaws, Lorraine?
Well, I've got a perfect example, yeah. All she's been in is the bloody Jaws film. She's not been in anything else.
She came out for Jaws 4, didn't she?
Yeah.
The Revenge.
Yeah, with Kaneo.
And Marion Van
Peebles. I will catch that shark for you. Not for 5, but for 10. Wrong film. Sorry.
You were only supposed to blow its bloody face off.
Yeah, very good. I like that.
No, but Marion Van Peebles is in Jaws 4, I remember.
Oh, God.
Whatever happened to him? What were we talking about? Yeah. Karen Allen's character, Marion, what does she do in Crystal Skull? She just drives the car, doesn't she? There's no real depth to her role.
No depth.
They could have made so much more of that. So she doesn't do much. Winston's character's annoying.
Winston's just dead annoying.
And the biggest annoyance of the whole film is Muck's character for me. Now, I know Shia LaBeouf gets so much stick for the film, and everyone says that Shia LaBeouf has ruined it, but I don't think it's him. I think it's the way the character's written. He's just cocky and unlikable.
Yeah, unlikable, yeah.
And originally he was written as a nerd, but they wanted him to be somebody that Indiana would not like. You know, he would be the disapproving dad.
I think what's disappointing is that the sort of the juxtaposition of Indy with his son against Indy with his dad doesn't have the same appeal.
No.
And the appeal comes from, there's a nice rapport, of course, between Connery and Ford. So you've got with Connery and Ford that, you know, Junior, come on, Junior, you know, and all this kind of stuff going on, which is great. And Dad, what the hell are you doing? You know, whereas it's just like this kind of cocky arrogance that you get with LaBeouf's character. And there isn't the kind of, there isn't the same kind of sort of growing sort of love, or that the love's already been there, you know, because he didn't know about the kid, did he?
So no.
At first. And that's the only reason, I suppose, Marion's in it, really, isn't it? Because of the son factor sort of links them together and everything. And then they realise they're still in love and everything, which is kind of quite sweet. The ideas are nice. The thing with it is, mate, is I think that the ideas are nice, but some of it's a bit rushed. Some of it just doesn't quite fit, you know? And that's the thing that's...
There's also an element of, we've seen this before, you know, with the moving buildings at the end, you know, the stone monuments turn into...
The UFO.
I mean, another problem I have with it is that, as well as Marion not doing much, the aliens don't do much. I mean, their appearance is rubbish, really, isn't it? At the end, they just give the skull back and then they blow up Spalco's brain.
Yes.
Which is just by giving her too much information. And then they just fly off. I thought, you know, that, what was the point of it all, really?
I think, in a way, Crystal Skull is the step towards the kind of Marvel excess. That's what I would call it. Because the Marvel films, for me, and I've probably upset probably even some of our podcast listeners on this, because there are a lot of people that really like it. And don't get me wrong, I've seen a couple that are quite good. You know, the first Captain America film I thought was really, there was a lot of really good things about it. But with a lot of them, it goes from one big piece scene to another, one big action scene to another, link to link, with very little breathing space. The end Star Wars films did the same as well. It's just sequence, little bit of plot in between massive sequence. I think that gets quite tiresome, you know.
Yeah.
I think films that allow a little bit more chance to breathe, and actually, if you look back at Raiders does a lot of that. Yeah. We think of Raiders, especially when we were kids, as the best non-stop action. But there's actually lots of scenes. And I think, and I'm thinking back to that scene where they're on the trucks through the jungle and they're fighting each other and everything.
Oh, God, that's the worst scene, isn't it?
It just goes on and on. It's,
and then it gets swinging through the bloody trees like Tarzan.
Tedious. Whereas the best set piece scene, I thought, was the bit when they go into sort of the Mayan temple bit and they're looking, and those, and the people come out for the, they come out of nowhere, these Mayans who are protecting the, you know, it's a while ago since I've seen it, so I can't even remember the reason why they were there. But you know the scene I mean?
Yeah.
And it's really, and it's quite creepy. It's quite suspenseful. Mm. It's got a lot of atmosphere. And then it kicks off. That, to me, is the best scene in the film. That and the opening scene with the nuclear bomb. That's fabulous.
Yeah.
That's a great opening. And the Conquistador scene is superb. It's an incredibly hard job, isn't it, to leave something for, like, 15 years and come back to it when it's been a cherished, an absolutely bloody cherished set of films. I think one of the great ironies of the film, though, is that maybe they brought in the sort of device of the Indy's son to sort of pull away from the fact that Harrison Ford was becoming an old man, you know, and he was really getting on by then. And actually, they didn't need that because he was still Indy. I thought he was great in it. He was really good in it. He was still a fit, pretty agile guy. I mean, he always... The thing with Indiana Jones was, as well, even in Raiders, he's kind of... You know, he can handle himself and he's fit and everything, but he's always a bit weary.
Yes.
He's always like, oh, my God, I've got to run now. Oh, my God, I've got to fight this guy now. And he is human. You know, he does absolutely knackered. It's adrenaline that keeps him going. Up until the point when he sees some Arab swinging his sword and he just thinks, oh, fuck it, and he just shoots him dead. Yeah. Like in which, you know, everyone cheered in the theatre, of course, which is a great, wonderful sort of accident that that happened. But in a way, that's so in keeping with the character of Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones just, he couldn't be doing with it. He just wanted to get in there, get what he needed and get the fuck out. That
well, there's that great scene in Crusade where his dad just says, what next? And he goes, yeah. I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along.
Yeah, exactly. That is brilliant. Obviously, it'd be a bit naive to go and watch an Indiana Jones film and not expect there to be sort of crazy over-the-top elements that were far-fetched and everything else. And that's not the point. I think we had a mix of wanting it to perhaps be a little bit more sophisticated for us at that age, but still holding all the charm from our youth. And it can't do that. It can't be everything for every man, you know, as much as you try. Raiders can, because all those scenes mean so much and reflect on how you felt at the time of watching it, because it meant so much, just like Jaws does. But also, they perhaps are superior films. And there's very few sequels that are superior to any originals. It's just so difficult. I mean, I'm not the world's biggest Star Wars fan, but Star Wars, if you want to call whatever you call it, New Hope or whatever they call it today, you know, bullshit. Star Wars is going to watch that and go, that meant a lot at the time. That was great. And I still think it's great, even though it's, in a way, got kind of a low budget element to it. It's something real great quality about it, something different. And you get this latest one with all the fucking CGI. I just thought it was garbled load of crap. I just thought it was garbage.
Well, just seeing friends on Facebook who are massive Star Wars fans, they've been absolutely mortified by that last one. Can't even think what it's called, but yeah, it's like ruined the whole legacy of the films.
Yeah. When you're a kid and you're an inventive kid and creative kid like I was, you're kind of thinking about this scene and then what's going to happen and this and that and the other. And Star Wars, because I read about it and heard about it, it didn't do it. I'm sorry, but when I went to the pictures, it didn't. But Raiders fucking did. Every single minute of it did. Mm-hmm. The romance of it, the mystery of it, the action, the adventure, the idea of being a treasure hunter. Oh my God, the history, the supernatural. Wow. It was all there. In one package, fighting the Nazis, get in. And you're a cowboy, you're riding a horse and wearing a cowboy hat. It was like this multi-genre film when you think about it.
But actually, Dave, what we should do now, as we're getting near the end of the pod, is...
Certainly.
Let's rank the films.
Oh,
right. Okay. So what's your fourth favourite Indiana Jones film?
Okay, well, I think it's pretty straightforward. And the one thing I wanted to say about this film, from my very much faded memory about the night we went to see it, I do kind of think that we went maybe to the pub afterwards and we all came out thinking, oh, that, like you said, you know, God, plenty of adventure in there. Indiana Jones, fabulous. But I think as soon as we got to the pub and had a beer, we started picking holes in it. And for that reason, and for the fact that some of the actors just overplay their parts and are just a bit poor in it, really, Crystal Skull is number four for me.
Yeah, I would agree. What about number three?
Number three, and I say this with a heavy heart because I love some scenes in it. It's got an amazing opening sequence. It's got a wonderful kind of supernatural element, which I'm all, you know me, I'm all in for supernatural elements. And a bit of the occult and a bit of devil worship, if you like. But I do kind of think that Temple of Doom doesn't quite hit the mark.
Right. I think I'm going to put Temple of Doom second for me because...
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think for years and years and years, like I say, Last Crusade was my favourite. But since I've been watching them again with my son...
Oh, great.
I think... And there's only a cigarette paper between the two of them. I'm going to put Crusade third. Oh, because I have a real fondness for Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
And I admire the fact that it does something different.
Yeah.
And I really think it pulls it off. I think it's got everything. It's fast-paced. It's got great characters. Yeah. It's got a great storyline. I love the idea of the thuggy cult and the chakra stones. And it's got a great baddie in it, Mola Ram. And the minecart chase is amazing. Like I say, there's hardly anything to choose between them. But I think I'm going to put Crusade third, and I'm going to put Temple second. So you're the other way around, obviously.
Indeed, the reason that I think I'm going to put Crusade in second place is because it's got a lovely opening sequence.
That is a great sequence.
Super sequence with the late great River Phoenix, who was sadly taken from us too young, and he would have been as big as his brother is today, as a movie star, I think. And that was perfect casting as the young Indiana.
Well, again, that was Harrison Ford, Dave, because he'd starred with him in Mosquito Coast.
That's correct.
And he said to Lucas and Spielberg, he says, he's a great actor, this kid, and he looks the most like me when I was a kid of all the other young actors out there.
Wow, fantastic. I didn't know that. Lee, these facts are brilliant tonight, mate. Well, I have to say that works a treat. And Connery, as his dad, it's fab.
He is the star of the film.
He's the star of the film. And I think that Ford allows that to happen brilliantly. I think Ford is fabulous in that. He doesn't try and steal scenes off Connery. He knows Connery's got the gravitas. And, you know, he's this respected sort of big Hollywood name. Nobody tries to outplay each other. It's just perfectly done. It's really, really well done, that relationship between the two of them. And that kind of overrides a lot of any little fault in the film, really, for me. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, it has got a few faults in it, but few and far between, really. It's a cracking story. I think Denham Elliott's lovely in it as well. And, you know, and I think he died not so long after too, didn't he? You know, very sad demise for Denham Elliott. He died of AIDS, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I just think it's charming. That's the word I'm looking for. There's a charm about it. It seemed to be a fitting way to finish the series of films, really, to me.
It did. So number one, no surprise, we both have Raiders. And for all the reasons we've mentioned, but is definitely up there in my top five films of
all. It's kind of perfect. It's every sequence, the opening sequence to the very end when they're pushing the Ark into the storage, the massive warehouse just being pushed away. This incredible artifact that can cause such damage and has such power is just rolled away into this big warehouse.
The one scene I love, Dave, and it really sets it up brilliantly, is just after the opening bit where he's back at the university.
Yes. Yeah.
And he gets called in to see these guys.
Yes. That is a great.
There's just something about the way that scene is done.
Because it's
so good. Because it sets the film up and you're getting a bit scared because they're talking about this artifact from God and its power.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful story link that does not seem contrived. And it powers the film, that scene. And it sets everything up with that air of mystery. It's kind of like the little key scene when you're reading, say, a Tintin story.
Yeah.
And I think that also relates very closely. Like one of the better Tintin stories has that little moment where it sets Tintin and Haddock off on an adventure. And that's exactly what happens in that scene. Suddenly, he's off on a new adventure.
Yeah.
But you're aware of some of the dangers that this incredible mystical thing.
I think what works is some of the cutaways to Denham Elliott's face.
Yes.
You know, because he's looking like pretty spooked and excited at the same time. And it's brilliant. But of course, Spielberg did a Tintin film, didn't he?
He did indeed. Well, what's really interesting there is he noted that Tintin was. Became to his attention when him and Lucas were starting to talk about making Raiders of the Lost Ark, because Hergé had said, the writer of Tintin, that the only person he would have ever accepted making a big film would be Spielberg, because he felt that Spielberg understood what he wanted. Yeah. And so he was very aware of Tintin and was impressed by the idea, the kind of, like, you know, the serialized element of Tintin. So, yeah, you know, a lot of things in Tintin mirrored that kind of idea of the Saturday morning.
That's true. You can see it being a bit of an influence, can't you?
Absolutely. The Saturday morning serial, which was all based on Join Us Next Week, Will He Survive This? So you'd turn a page as, say, a car was going off a cliff, and then you'd be like, the next page you'd realise that Tintin managed to grab hold of the tree.
This is the thing that Annie Wilkes points out in Misery, isn't it? That they always cheated you. You'd see the car going over the cliff with the guy in it.
Yeah.
But then when it came on the next week, the guy would get out before it
exactly.
went over the cliff.
Exactly. The two key really important things in Raiders, I think, is you've named one of them perfectly there, pal, which is the supposition in the film isn't ladled into your face in a really obvious way. And this is part of the problem with a lot of these fucking films today, like the Marvel films and others of its like the Star Wars trilogy. They try and pack in this supposition in a conversation, you know, and then go on with these big scenes where the supposition is done very neatly and subtly, and then you move on. So you completely understand where you're going in the story, but not in a way that's like patronizing to you as an audience. And I think that's been beautifully done in Raiders. Spielberg's a real dab hand at that.
They tried to do it in Last Crusade, where he meets Walter Donovan.
Yeah.
They probably do it in a bit of a crap way, because they do tell the whole history of the Grail.
Yes.
In about 2 minutes.
I was going to say, this is probably the problem with most of the other films. There is a little too much supposition used at different times. Then they go, oh, here we go.
A bit over-explanation.
This is for the benefit of the audience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The other thing with Raiders that's done perfectly is in keeping with that idea of the serialized story. So there are all these scenes where will Indy escape the rolling ball in the mine? Will Indy be able to defeat the huge, strong German who's fighting him in front of the plane? Will he get out of the Well of Souls? Will he be crushed under the wheels of the truck? And it's perfect, because there's so many parts of Raiders of the Lost Ark where you could just stop it and say, join us next week.
Well, being the first film, you obviously weren't sure whether Indy was, you know, infallible.
Exactly.
He could have been killed off halfway Indeed. Through the film, couldn't he?
Absolutely. As a kid of 13 or 14, whatever it was, 12, I don't know, everything worked. All the cogs in the machine worked perfectly. For me, at that age, it was the perfect film. I hadn't seen anything that worked quite so perfectly.
Right, Dave, is there anything you want to say before we finish?
No, I just want to say thank you very much, Lee, for suggesting this as a subject. I think it's been fascinating.
Oh, did I suggest it?
Yes, you did. You said, let's do the Raiders films.
Please, listeners, if you have a minute or are inclined to do so, please rate us on iTunes and other platforms.
Yeah, please rate us.
It does all help. And we all love to hear from you. We do have Facebook and Twitter, so we'd love to hear what you think. Good night, Dave.
Good night, Lee. Everybody. All the best, mate. I'm glad you're feeling a lot better after your jab.
Yeah, thanks very much. power.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful story link that does not seem contrived. And it powers the film, that scene. And it sets everything up with that air of mystery. It's kind of like the little key scene when you're reading, say, a Tintin story.
Yeah.
And I think that also relates very closely. Like, one of the better Tintin stories has that little moment where it sets Tintin and Haddock off on an adventure. And that's exactly what happens in that scene. Suddenly, he's off on a new adventure.
Yeah.
But you're aware of some of the dangers that this incredible mystical thing...
I think what works is some of the cutaways to Denham Elliott's face.
Yes.
You know, because he's looking like pretty spooked and excited at the same time. And it's brilliant. But of course, Spielberg did a Tintin film, didn't he?
He did indeed. Well, what's really interesting there is he noted that Tintin was, became to his attention when him and Lucas were starting to talk about making Raiders of the Lost Ark, because Hergé had said, the writer of Tintin, that the only person he would have ever accepted making a big film would be Spielberg, because he felt that Spielberg understood what he wanted. Yeah. And so he was very aware of Tintin and was impressed by the idea, the kind of, like, you know, the serialized element of Tintin. So, you know, a lot of things in Tintin mirrored that kind of idea of the Saturday morning.
That's true. You can see it being a bit of an influence, can't you?
Absolutely. The Saturday morning serial, which was all based on Join Us Next Week, Will He Survive This? So you'd turn a page as, say, a car was going off a cliff, and then you'd be like, the next page you'd realise that Tintin managed to grab hold of the tree.
This is the thing that Annie Wilkes points out in Misery, isn't it? That they always cheated you. You'd see the car going over the cliff with the guy in it.
Yeah.
But then when it came on the next week, the guy would get out before it
exactly.
went over the cliff.
Exactly. The two key really important things in Raiders, I think, is you've named one of them perfectly there, pal, which is the supposition in the film